Welcome to CFRI Cystic Fibrosis Community Voices, a video podcast series created by and for the cystic fibrosis community.
Okay, so this is the title of my talk, and what I'm going to be focusing on is one aspect of CF infection. And as we all know, infections in CF are a central issue and largely responsible for many of the symptoms and for the life-shortening aspect of CF. We're mostly aware of and focused on bacteria. That's where infection really emerges as a problem and where a lot of the focus of clinical care still exists today, but it's really one of a triad of different problems infecting the CF lung. We all know about viruses. We know the relationship of colds and other respiratory viruses to CF. About half of exacerbations, it's thought, are related to viral infections. So this is another enormously important area, not as well understood as bacterial infection. But what I'm going to focus on today are the third member of this triad, the fungi. So let's start by just reviewing what we're talking about. What are fungi? Well, fungi are different from plants and animals. They live in their own world and are called a separate kingdom by biologists, and they belong to that part of life where cells have a nucleus, or eukaryotic organisms. Fungi are largely hidden from view. They really live underground. And what we know and see of fungi are really the fruiting bodies and the seeds or spores that fungi produce from their life under the earth. So it's a hidden kingdom of life that we're talking about. They can exist as single cells. More commonly, they form chains or bunches of cells together. And when they're existing in that format, they form sheets or mats that are called mycelia. And these are really tangled webs of these long chains of cells that are called hyphae. So we have the eukaryotic portions of life, the animals, the plants, and the fungi as their separate kingdom, and bacteria, not shown on this slide, are viruses, which are simply the genetic material with a sort of protein sheath around them. But with starting with bacteria, you have cells that have different functions or metabolic processes within them. And then when we go to the eukaryotic part of life, we have nuclei where the genetic material is held, and then organelles outside the nuclei and the cytoplasm. Within fungi, there are lots of different classifications and phylum based on the genetics. And the one shown here, called Ascomycota, is the one that contains many of the problems that we're dealing with clinically. So what are the fungal suspects in cystic fibrosis? This is a table that kind of graphs for you our current understanding of what we see when we find these organisms in people. Some of them are persisting and some of them are transient. Some are well established with relationship to human illness and a lot of them aren't. And as you can see here, there are quite a few that are related to cystic fibrosis. I'm going to be emphasizing in the talk the most troublesome one, Aspergillus fumigatus, but towards the end I'll also come back to some of the others that we are finding and discuss those. So what is Aspergillus? Within that kingdom of fungi and that phylum of Ascomycota, Aspergillus is one of the genera. And there are about 200 different species of Aspergillus that have been found around the world. And these classifications are based on relationships of the genetic material, the DNA. We can identify them in lab by looking at them under the microscope, looking at their structure and their appearance. And that's the sort of the traditional way and being displaced these days by molecular and genetic techniques. So they can appear as either single cells, which are called yeast. And in CF, yeasts are very common, and you may be familiar with Candida, the organism that causes thrush. That's also found in the respiratory tract very commonly, as I'll show you. But more commonly, many organisms are found as these chains called hyphae, and Aspergillus is one of the hyphae-producing fungi. We call those filamentous because they're little filaments. These mycelia look like filaments as opposed to the single-celled organism. They reproduce by forming little organisms at the end of these filaments, or hyphae, that are called conidial bodies, and they release the spores, which scientifically are called conidia, as you can see there. What's the life cycle that we're talking about? Well, let's start with the spores. They cause problems by inhalation. So they're deposited in the lungs, and in certain conditions, including cystic fibrosis, they are able to start growing in the mucus plugs in the lungs. So these little spores recognize an environment that's friendly, and then they will start to grow, forming little tubes called germ tubes, and eventually the hyphae form, and they will elongate, and Aspergillus in particular branches out into this mat. So this massive hyphae then becomes a fungal ball if unchecked, and it then continues to grow, and then will form the fruiting bodies, the conidial bodies, and give off the spores, and the cycle begins again. How are we exposed to this? Well, we breathe in the spores. The spores are in the air. In this room, the spores are here. They're everywhere. And each day it's estimated that, on average, we inhale several hundred Aspergillus spores. So it's really part of the ubiquitous biosphere that we live in. And you find it in the soil, but you also can find it in vegetative areas, particularly plants that are breaking down, in various areas related to industrial life. And one thing that we worry about in healthcare in particular is that, ironically, the spores are found in very high concentrations in construction sites, including when hospitals are being built or renovated, like Lucile Packard. So this is a time of anxiety and lots of environmental monitoring in healthcare because of this particular issue with Aspergillus spores in the air. So who's at risk for having trouble? Well, it's not just CF people. Aspergillus is one of the very few organisms that's able to cause both infections and also allergic disease, depending upon the immune status of the host, of the person. So as you see here, the frequency of infections with Aspergillus has a kind of U-shaped curve where you have very high frequency in people that are heavily immunosuppressed. So is that relevant to CF? The answer is yes, if you've had a lung transplant, because then you're getting immunosuppressive medications. But there are many other types of people that are at risk in this group, other kinds of transplantation, people with cancer, people with primary or acquired immune deficiencies. On the other side, though, you have the immune system being hyped up, overactive, and that's also a risk factor for the other kind of disease, which is an allergic kind of reaction where the host is producing the damage through its immune response to the organism. And for the most part, this is where the problems reside in CF, except for the transplant population. That raises the initial question. There are thousands, hundreds of thousands of different species of molds. Why is Aspergillus, in particular the species Aspergillus fumigatus, so uniquely troublesome? There's a lot of answers for this. The way it produces spores that have particular characteristics that make it troublesome. They're very dispersible because of their size and the fact that they have a coating that is hydrophobic. It pushes water away. It doesn't coalesce into droplets, settle in the ground. It stays in the air. And the size is such is that it can stay in the air a long time. The size is also such that when you breathe it in, it goes past the nose and the defenses of the upper respiratory tract, nose and mouth, and gets down into the lower airways. And it's big enough so it doesn't get as far as the air sacs. It tends to deposit right in the small airways, which are also the main site of CF lung disease based on CFTR biology and pathology. In addition, Aspergillus is a pretty sophisticated organism for a little mold. It has 10,000 genes, which is about half the number of genes that you and I have. So it has a tremendous ability to turn genes on and off depending upon stresses in the environment and its response to them. So it can deal with situations, for example, of low oxygen, low iron, low sugar, low protein, nitrogen. So it's able to adapt to a lot of challenges and survive in very adverse environments, in fact, a very wide range of temperature. But the temperature it likes best of all to grow on is 37 degrees centigrade, which is the human body temperature. So it seems to be almost uniquely adapted to survive inside the human body if the person has a problem with normal defense of the lungs. It also produces a lot of potentially bad molecules, toxins, adaptation molecules like those that adhere to the walls of cells, things like that that can allow it to survive. So it's extremely adaptable and a very clever organism. And in this regard, it's really a lot like our other big troublemaker in CF, Pseudomonas aeruginosa, which is a gram-negative bacteria, but they both have this tremendous adaptability, and that's something that's been studied pretty extensively for both of these organisms in the setting of a person with CF inside the airways. If you actually look, you can see the Aspergillus in the sputum plugs that people with CF get. This is a view under a microscope where we can actually see in the mucus the Aspergillus hyphae growing very comfortably within the sputum plug. And in the little inset, you can see some of the damage that's caused that's visible right in the sputum plug. Some of the cells are being sloughed off, the epithelial cell, which is here, and also white blood cells called neutrophils, which are the main white cells that the body is throwing in to defend against this organism that it recognizes as foreign. So how common is it? This is the first one of the first problems that we have to deal with. The way most people answer that is to look at registry information. So like the CF Foundation registry in the US, there's also registries in many countries in Western Europe, and also Australia, New Zealand, where CF patients are mainly found. And these registries reflect information provided by people at the centers based on reports that they get from their microbiology labs, which are in turn based on orders given by the physicians at that center. And what you see here is a trend that was noticed starting in the mid-90s, going up to the mid-aughts, of about a doubling in the reported prevalence of Aspergillus and CF. In 2005, it had more than doubled from about 6% to 13% of patients. And in the most recent register report that I've seen from 2015, it was about 14%. So it seems to have plateaued a bit in registry reporting. The other very common mold is Candida, which I mentioned before is a yeast, unlike Aspergillus, the filamentous fungus, and that has a bit higher incidence in the US registry of 17%. But if you look a little bit more closely into the registry, what you see is a tremendous variability. So what we see here is the report for 2013, where we see this bar indicates the range reported by different centers. And you'll notice on the left, it starts at zero. Some centers find zero molds in patients. Others will find up to more than a third, 36%, and up to almost three quarters for Candida. So this variability is telling you something right away, and that is that we've got a problem with detection. Similar data from are available from the UK, and you see here for adults for a fairly similar time period, 2007 to 2012. Again, this phenomenon of doubling from about 6 to 13, 14% for Aspergillus, while in their particular registry, Candida is less prevalent, hovering about 3 to 4%. So is this a real figure? Do these really represent the scope of the problem? The answer is certainly not. And this is illustrated here by a study that looked particularly at laboratory variability in finding fungi in CF sputum cultures. And let's just focus on Aspergillus fumigatus. That's what we've been talking about. And what you see here are two hospitals in the same city in the UK, in Bristol, and three places in France in this particular study. And if you just scan along that row and look at the figures in parentheses, you'll see a tremendous variability from less than 10% to over almost 90%, which kind of reflects the variability that we saw in the registry reports, only these numbers go much higher at the upper end. So what is that really showing us? Well, it's telling us that there are a huge number of variables in fungal detection, which I've tried to list here, starting with geography. Depending on the environment and the weather, you can get wide variability in exposure and therefore prevalence rates. So the climate of the environment has a role. There are also secular trends over time, which medical parlance means changing demographics of the population over time. CF is something we know has changed tremendously over the last 20 or 30 years. And also these differences in treatment, which can have a big effect, which I'll show you in a few moments. Going into the lab, there are many variables that are lab dependent. These include the type of culture media that are used, which can select out fungi or not. How often you do it, the more you seek, the more you find. So if you're doing one culture a couple every few years, that's different from doing it twice a year or quarterly. The type of sampling actually is important. You're doing a throat swab, you're looking at a sputum that's coughed out, are you inducing the sputum, are you doing a bronchoscopy? Once you get the sample in the lab, how long are you letting it grow for? Because some fungi will grow more quickly than others. Turns out it's important how much of the sample you actually put on that culture plate, and whether or not you break up the plugs through a system called sonication, or rapid shaking, or whether you use a drug like DNase or some other chemical to make the sputum more liquid, and whether or not you put antibiotics in to suppress the growth of bacteria. And lastly, and this has been a big issue over the last 10 years or so, whether or not you're actually supplementing or replacing your cultures with modern molecular techniques to look at fungal DNA directly. These are techniques that involve something called PCR or sequencing, which allow you to detect the DNA of foreign organisms that might be in a sample. So just to give you a flavor of what happens when you do some of these things, this is a study that was done in Northern Ireland, published about 8 years ago, where the traditional method of culturing was compared to use of fungal specific media on a portion of the same sample, and again another portion taken for direct DNA detection. And as you see here, about 18% of the samples in this particular study were positive when the traditional culture was done. And in many cases, they noted there was overgrowth of bacteria because this particular culture media encourages the growth of bacteria more so than fungi. But if you use a specific fungal culture medium, you go from 18% way up to 78% in this same sample. And if you do DNA detection, you can find it in every single case. So this gives you an idea of the scope of the problem and the difficulty in really putting our finger on just how common the problem is. Turns out that the first study done in the United States ever using fungal-specific media was only reported last year, and I'm showing that here. This is from the Adult Center at Johns Hopkins, where they enrolled 211 of their adult CF patients over a year. So most of these folks gave more than one sample. The average was a little over two samples per subject. And what you see on the left-hand side is the result with bacterial culture showing only about a quarter of the samples positive for fungi. But then below that, you see a list of other abbreviations for different culture media which are more specific for fungi, and you can see there that the numbers shoot up to 85%. They also wanted to look at the issue of whether somebody is growing something repeatedly or just on a single sample, which could indicate maybe that they cleared the organism and it's not a problem. So what you see there on the bottom left is a comparison of those that had a single isolation and those that had multiple isolations in the darker. And overall, if you look at the results, about 40% of their adults were growing Aspergillus fumigatus at least once, and about half that number were growing it repeatedly, or having persistent Aspergillus, at least colonization, if not infection. And also shown there are some of the other less common fungi that I'll talk about briefly later. So is this a unique study, or is it really reflecting what the real situation is? I think it's the latter. You can see there that study result is shown in a red bar, and then three other studies listed here in the blue and green bars, and also the inset table show that about between 30 and 40% of CF patients have Aspergillus fumigatus, just based on using selective fungal media. So the next question is, what are the risk factors for not being able to get rid of this? Remember, we're breathing in the spores all the time. Healthy people can get rid of those spores easily through innate immune defense, the mucociliary clearance, and some of the resident cells that are present in the airway, such as macrophages. But with folks with CF, we have this problem of perhaps 20 to 30% with persistent Aspergillus colonization. What are the risk factors here? Again, this was a work that's been done recently, just recently reported from Johns Hopkins, using the CF registry instead of their own center at this, in this particular study. And this is an example of how the registry gets used for epidemiologic studies. You start with a slice of time, in this case from 2004 to 12, with all the different individuals in the registry, about 34,000, so it's extremely powerful in terms of the size. And then you start excluding people who are irrelevant or don't give you the information that you need, and that's the flow chart there on that left-hand side. You can see that some of these people were excluded because they didn't have sufficient culture results reported in the registry. Others were excluded because they wanted to find out the incidence, that is, the new appearance of persistent Aspergillus. So they took out people who already had Aspergillus at the start. They only wanted those that acquired it and then had persisting recovery of the Aspergillus. And looking at the results here in the form of this table, some of these are demographic differences that show up as statistically significant. It turns out that being white is a bit more of a risk factor. Of course, this applies to most patients with CF. Having pancreatic insufficiency is a risk factor. Again, most patients have this problem, so this is not particularly helpful. Down at the bottom, you see there that certain infections appear to be a risk factor, and importantly, Pseudomonas is the one that shows up as the most important, and there's now a growing literature about the relationship between Pseudomonas and Aspergillus that have certain interplay between them. And in fact, there's a whole new field now looking at how multiple organisms interact within the respiratory tract. But perhaps the most important thing here is the effect that we have as providers in giving treatments to patients. And you can see here that the use of antibiotics really does affect this risk for having chronic Aspergillus, as well as the use of inhaled steroids. Does this mean we shouldn't be using these medications? Of course not, but that it does mean that we need to be aware of the fact that there are always unintended consequences of some of the things that we do. And we really don't know for sure that the use is causing it. It could be that the patient is sicker already, and therefore that's the reason that they're getting the antibiotics. So whether it's a chicken or egg cannot be determined by epidemiologic studies. You have to do longitudinal studies over time and have ideally controlled studies to know what's really causal in something like this. But certainly there's that association. This is a study from the UK from Leicester, which looked at children, because we were interested in the issue of when all this starts and how young can you be to be at risk. So these are the recovery of organisms in a pediatric cohort at their pediatric center in Leicester. And there are 45 patients in here, and you can see that it's a combination, because they're kids, of sputum cultures and bronchoscopy cultures. And Candida is the most frequently recovered organism in this particular sample, and I think that's something that's widely agreed with. Staph aureus, we know, is an early bacterial problem in CF, and that shows up also. But then third is aspergillus with over 40% in their particular study, more common in this particular cohort at this time, which is around 2008, 2010, than Pseudomonas. Tracking along, you can see that it's not frequently recovered early in childhood, but by the time of the preteen to teen years, it starts to show up and seems to be something that is happening primarily in the teen years. So the median age of the first positive culture was 9 with a range of 3 to 16, but averaging around that preteen age group. There's been more work done on this in Europe than in the States, and this is a multi-center report from various countries in the European Union. Aspergillus is this blue line here, and you can see that it also shows an upward trend that really starts to take off around 10 to 12 years of age, but then plateaus in the mid-teen years and doesn't keep going up and up and up, which is kind of interesting too. It kind of stabilizes at around 20%. And again, these are based on center reports. So we have this issue of how sensitive the data are. Okay, so we've seen that it's a lot more common than you get the impression of from registry. We see that there are issues. There's no standardization in how we look for this at this point, which has a problem that's been largely solved for bacteria, but we're just approaching now for fungi and CF. But really, what does it really mean for people with CF in terms of whether or not they're having some kind of problem with this? So that's where we get into this issue of what we call phenotypes, which really is a fancy name for clinical manifestations. And if you think about it, you can start with what's called colonization, where something is growing. You have bacteria growing on your skin. It's not making you sick. They're simply living there. You have bacteria in your gut. We all have that microbiome. So there's a normal growth of organisms in our body. We have more bacteria in our body than we have our own cells. So colonization is certainly a consideration, and if you detect it, it could be for the first time, or it could be something that's there for a little bit of time and then cleared, or it could be persistent. But then you get the issue of, is it starting to cause harm? And that's where the word infection will come in. The body is starting to respond with immune and inflammatory responses that can cause damage to the tissues. So as regards this problem, that could be in the form of a bronchitis, where it's growing in the airway and creating excessive inflammation with increasing cough and sometimes systemic symptoms like fever or malaise, things like that. As I mentioned, if unchecked, the growth can be into a large fungal ball, and these can actually be visible. They can grow in size to where they're several centimeters in diameter. And this will happen especially if there's already a cavity. If you have bad bronchiectasis, which is a ballooning of the airway, you can get a fungal ball growing there. So that then becomes something that's impossible to get rid of. In some cases, you can get a chronic low-grade invasion of the tissues around the mucus plug, which is called chronic pulmonary aspergillosis. And if you're really sick, and you don't have to be completely immunosuppressed, for example, if you have poorly controlled diabetes, the organism can then start to invade blood vessels and spread and become a systemic infection. That's invasive pulmonary aspergillosis. That's a very devastating infection. That's a huge problem in immunosuppressed people, but has also been reported, although thankfully rarely, in CF. On the hyperimmune side, you can get simple allergic sensitization. In other words, if you do an allergy skin test, you'll see a hive there because the body is producing an allergic antibody that can create a reaction when exposed to some molecule from the organism. So that can be a simple sensitization. Doesn't necessarily cause disease, but if it causes disease, it's likely to be in the form of some kind of asthmatic manifestation. And this can either be plain fungal asthma or become a severe asthma. There's actually a separate syndrome now called severe asthma with fungal sensitization, which is thought to represent a quarter to a half of all cases of severe asthma. And there are various ways to classify the severity of asthma, but that's a recognized entity. At the far end of that, you have something called allergic bronchopulmonary aspergillosis, or ABPA, which is probably the best recognized clinical problem for CF. And it shouldn't be forgotten that you can have overlap between a number of these different things in the same person simultaneously or evolving over time. So it's a really quite complicated set of issues. Just briefly, to talk about ABPA first, ABPA was something that was described in people with asthma in the 1950s, recognized in CF in the 1960s, and criteria for how to recognize and diagnose this, again, coming out of the asthma world, were developed in the 1970s and then adapted to CF. The CF Foundation, recognizing this problem, which really became apparent in the 90s, put together a consensus conference, which we held back in 2001, and published a paper from that in 2003, which listed the way that we diagnose this in CF patients, which is shown there, basically recognizing it as a cause of a pulmonary exacerbation, and then recognizing the immune response of the body as well as changes that might occur with imaging, either chest X-ray or chest CT. And in CF, one thing that's different from asthma is that CF care is organized. We have CF centers. We're able to see patients on a regular basis, and just looking at the epidemiology and the occurrence of ABPA as a problem, it was recommended, and now centers do this, follow the total IgE as a marker of the allergic response of the body starting at school age. That's very helpful because we now know that changes in that IgE level are an extremely good way to follow the occurrence and also the progress or the response to treatment of ABPA. But I don't want to leave the impression that Aspergillus fumigatus is the only cause of this particular problem, and there's a fairly long list of other fungi that can cause allergic bronchopulmonary mycoses or fungal allergic disease, which are shown here. But Aspergillus fumigatus is really responsible for over 90% of the total, so it still is by far the major player. It's just not the only possible cause of this particular and very troublesome disease. It's been known for a long time that ABPA is a clinical problem. If you have an exacerbation, obviously you're not feeling well, you may be hospitalized, you may be treated with antibiotics, they don't work because this is a fungus and not a bacteria. But more recent data indicate that it's really also something that you can detect by other very sensitive and objective measures. So this is a study from Copenhagen that was recently published looking at ABPA and pediatric cases of CF as opposed to those that have other forms of infection. And what you see there on the left is that the CT score is a way of grading the severity of structural damage is greater. And on the right-hand side, a test of airway inhomogeneity, the lung clearance index, which shows that there's more trapping and non-functional lung tissue in the cases of ABPA than in other forms of infection. So it's a bad problem to have. And in adults, we have information like this from a study that was done in Manchester in the UK, which looked at the rate of decline in lung function as measured by FEV1. And what they did here was to categorize different forms of or phenotypes of Aspergillus clinical problems. So we have one group that doesn't have Aspergillus on the left there, the ABPA group, about 18% of their adult clinic. Those that had simple allergy without having all the manifestations of ABPA, and on the right-hand side, Aspergillus bronchitis. And they were able to differentiate these based on some tests that they have developed using blood markers of the immune response, but also some markers in the sputum of the amount of fungi in the airways using some biomarker testing. And what you see here is that those with ABPA had the fastest decline in their lung function, but those that were simply allergic also had a decline, and those with bronchitis had a trend toward a greater decline, all compared to those that didn't have any evidence of Aspergillus. So all of these phenotypes are either shown to be, or in this particular case, given the numbers involved, trending towards definition of real clinical problems. Now, ABPA is something that requires different treatments. These were, again, developed back in the 1960s, starting with cortisone-type drugs, steroids. We still use those as the front line of therapy. But we know that chronic use of steroids is really troublesome, particularly because we need to give long courses for this problem, and that results in a lot of side effects. There are studies that have validated the use of steroids, again, going back over decades. And recently, we've come up with an alternative to giving a chronic exposure to an oral steroid like prednisone by instead having the patient come in and get a monthly dose of intravenous steroids at very high dose. That's called pulse therapy, which is less likely to produce some of these chronic side effects. More recently, we have really taken to the use of antifungal drugs, and there's a group of antifungal drugs called azoles, which are effective against aspergillus. And the three of them available, actually there's a fourth one now, three of which have been used in ABPA are listed there, itraconazole, voriconazole, and posaconazole. And there have been studies primarily in people with asthma rather than CF ABPA, which have validated their use. The problem there, again, is toxicity, but also variability. These are drugs that are handled by the liver. We know that the liver is involved in CF. Absorption is difficult for at least itraconazole, so there's a great variability in the amount of drug that actually winds up being in the body. And unless you're measuring that, that's a problem. And I'll also show you some resistance figures in a moment. You can have an alternative, which is to inhale another antifungal drug called amphotericin. Amphotericin is a very toxic drug, but if you inhale it, the toxicity on the rest of the body is limited, and so that's had some use, particularly in the transplant setting for CF. And then over the last 10 years, we've really had a great increase in the use of a biological agent, which is what's called a monoclonal antibody, which is an antibody that's uniform, produced pharmaceutically, which is against IgE, which is that allergic protein in the body. And that's now been well validated, primarily in asthma patients, but there's a good amount of data also in CF. Unfortunately, it's very expensive as a biological agent, and you have to get it by injection every 2 to 4 weeks. But the dosing that's been used for asthma, where the IgE levels are lower, actually also has been shown to work in people with ABPA who have much higher levels of IgE. So it is certainly something to consider. The problem is that it's because of this variety of different treatments, there's a lot of variability. So we've had the variability in detection, we have the variability in clinical manifestation, and now we got the variability in treatment. This is a recent study from the UK where they asked CF consultants at their CF centers how they treat ABPA, either at the first initial diagnosis or if there's a relapse. In other words, someone is treated, gets better, and then gets worse again later and needs to get retreated. And what you can see there, just looking at the figure, is that there's quite a bit of difference between the different providers, and also significant differences between those that take care of adults and those that take care of kids. The kids are likely to get treated with some different drugs and more likely to have a combination of an azole as well as steroids. There are lots of aspects of CF that affect the treatment, the complexity of the infection, the fact that asthma is pretty common as a manifestation in CF, the issue of glucose intolerance and diabetes. Steroids make that a lot worse. Also, bone problems related to steroids, the liver disease, the fact that GI symptoms are so common that most folks with CF are taking some kind of antacid or acid suppressor, which will at least affect the absorption of itraconazole. And then most recently, a new problem, which is the interaction of these antifungal drugs with the CFTR modulators, particularly ivacaftor. And so that is something that has to be taken into account when prescribing and using them. And there are a bunch of different side effects which are listed here, including GI side effects, nervous system, and skin. In particular, for voriconazole, eyes and skin are affected, and so that becomes a problem for some patients. And finally, the fact that without measuring the drug level, it's very hard to know if you're treating undershooting or overshooting because of the variability in the metabolism through the liver of these drugs. Most recently, we're aware of the fact that resistance, just like resistance to antibiotics is a problem for things like MRSA, resistance to these antifungal agents is emerging as a problem in treating Aspergillus. So these are studies shown here for Germany and also the Netherlands that show between 5% and 10% of patients with CF are showing resistance in their Aspergillus to the drugs that are used. We did a recent study of this, and similar result is 7% of our patients in our clinic are resistant to voriconazole. What about chronic infection? So this really got kicked off by looking at the outcomes of patients. This was a study that was influential from the Hospital for Sick Kids in Toronto, where we see those that were either co-infected with Pseudomonas or just with Aspergillus, had lower lung function over time, and also had more exacerbations, more hospitalization. So that suggested this is not the allergic situation. This is pure infection without the ABPA problem. Looking at it from the other side, there's a group of studies from Australia where they have newborn screened infants that are enrolled in a study where they get bronchoscopies starting at age 3 months, again at 1 year and at 2 years. Many things are collected, including bronchoalveolar lavage fluid for different studies, but also things like CAT scans and lung function, and then patients followed over time. So this is a prospective, long-term longitudinal study. And this particular one that I'm showing you is a list of risk factors for lower lung function in early school years, 4 to 8 years of age, in relation to what they found very early on in life. And one of the risk factors that they found that was significant and lowered the lung function about 11% was if you grew Aspergillus in the first 2 years of life. In fact, 13% of their infants in this and toddlers in this study had Aspergillus recovered before their third birthday. In another study in adults in the UK, you can see here that as compared to patients that had no fungi recovered, those that had Aspergillus or a combination of Aspergillus and other fungi had significantly lower lung function on the left there and required more treatment on the right, suggesting that this is also a problem. Now, in addressing the chicken and egg problem, are these people getting fungi because they're sicker to begin with, or is the fungi actually causing or contributing to the progression of disease? You have to do, again, these longitudinal studies. This is one that was done in Athens, where they had a group of patients, and they tracked them along, and they studied them until they acquired Aspergillus, and then they kept studying them afterwards. So what you're seeing there on the left is the 4 years before they acquired the Aspergillus, and the 7 years afterwards. And so the answer to this question seems to be, yes, they're worse to begin with. The people that have more lung disease are more likely to acquire Aspergillus, but then after they get it, they're also more likely to have further more progression of lung disease. So it seems that, based on this data, the answer is both chicken and egg. Now, this association is interesting. We have recent data from Europe that suggest that lung function measurements are lower in patients with persistent Aspergillus, as shown there. This is from registry data in Europe. But then if you break it down into those that do or don't have Pseudomonas, the effect is really pronounced mostly in those that don't have Pseudomonas. So it seems that the Pseudomonas infection can kind of mask the problem with Aspergillus and be a main driver of lung disease. And that, of course, has led to our focus on eradicating as well as trying to control Pseudomonas infection. And what about the CFTR modulators? Information is beginning to emerge that when we use these modulators like ivacaftor, we can actually affect the incidence of infection. So this is a study where patients with G551D, the first ivacaftor target population, was followed before and after treatment. And what you see here is that Pseudomonas is significantly reduced in the first year after after the institution of the use of ivacaftor. But we also see the same reduction in Aspergillus, suggesting that the modulator is actually producing some improvement in our ability to get rid of the organism. A study in Ireland, in Dublin, showed that the use of itraconazole in patients that were growing aspergillus repeatedly, treated for a short period of time, actually had a long-term benefit in terms of reducing the inflammatory components in their bronchoalveolar lavage fluid, but also stabilizing their lung function, improving their quality of life as measured by the CFQR, and stabilizing their structure as shown by CT examinations. So it looks like at least treating some patients with persistent aspergillus is of a benefit. But the answer is not definitive, and there's a study that's just been started recently, which is called the Antifungal Therapy During CF, or ATCF study, which is ongoing in 3 centers in Europe, 2 in France, and 1 in the UK. And although this is a little bit complicated, basically they're randomizing patients with persistent aspergillus to get either itraconazole or voriconazole and treating for 4 to 6 months and then following these patients. And to summarize the very early results, this is very preliminary data, they're showing an improvement in lung function, eradication of the organism, but after therapy is stopped, the problems tend to return. So this is one of those situations where it's kind of like a whack-a-mole situation. So it looks like this is a benefit as long as you're getting actively treated. So we have some criteria for which people to look at if you have at least 2 cultures over 6 months and you have some changes in your clinical picture, sputum, infiltrates, FEV1, and you're not responding to antibiotic therapy. And you can safely assume that it's not due to something like mycobacteria or Pseudomonas or something like that. And of course, if the person doesn't have ABPA, which is a separate treatable problem, those are the folks that are the target group for use of antifungals. At this point, we don't have any controlled trials. These are sort of expert opinions. They're not validated, and we don't have a weighting. Which of these factors might be more important than other factors? Let me finish up by just talking about a couple of the other less commonly isolated fungi. There are other species of Aspergillus. Scedosporium, you may have heard of that, is it's kind of being reshuffled in terms of the nomenclature and the naming, but we think it's now a 5-species complex. That's really emerging, up to 25% in some cases, and some studies have it, particularly in Australia, but perhaps also in other areas. Exophiala is another organism which also is emerging, and then some of these others, some candidal species. So you can see the increase here in Scedosporium. These are much lower numbers, but the trend upward over that same 2007-12 period in the adult UK registry population from a very low number up to upwards of 1% of their patients. In Germany, they have a reference lab where you send samples to a single reference lab which does all the fungal testing, and as you can see here, it's a kind of busy slide, but it's really showing that a wide variety of these other fungi are emerging and becoming more prevalent over the last 10 years in patients with CF, particularly as we treat bacteria more successfully. And just as I showed for Aspergillus, if you do molecular methods to detect instead of cultures, the numbers shoot way up, so that the culture column there shows low levels for Scedosporium, somewhat higher for Exophiala in blue, but then if you use these molecular techniques, you get much higher recovery rates. So again, we have this issue of what the true prevalence is still being somewhat unsettled. All we know is that it's getting more common. For Scedosporium, it's really a problem that we're still focused on mostly in the immunosuppressed patients, those that are listed or have gotten lung transplants, although there may be some particular patients that have clinical problems with persistent Scedosporium pre-transplant. And for Exophiala, this black yeast, we have better evidence that it may be inflammatory in terms of some studies that suggest it could be a problem even in the pre-transplant population. Now, Candida is very common. As I mentioned, the most commonly isolated mold in many places is Candida, and Candida albicans is the species that's usually described. This is the one that causes the thrush and vaginitis in females. But we also have other species of Candida that have been reported in CF. And as for these other less common organisms, it's still unclear as to how risky it is to have that. And that's been controversial. There have been some studies suggesting it's a problem and others suggesting that it really isn't a problem. So that remains to be resolved. So let me just end by giving a couple of conclusions. We know that we can screen for, detect, and treat ABPA, but the optimal treatment still remains to be determined and probably differs for different people with different problems. The scope of non-ABPA fungal disease, other forms of allergy, and also the infection question are not entirely clear, and that's mainly because we don't have an agreed-upon standardized detection method. And we also have difficulties in phenotyping or classifying the patients in terms of their clinical manifestations. But we do think that there are some patients that definitely have progression of disease associated with a chronic aspergillus infection who respond to antifungal therapy. And we have to keep an eye on some of these new organisms like Scedosporium and Exophiella, but at this time they're mainly problems in the transplant population. The hope is that there are new methods and biomarkers which will allow us to really solidify our understanding of a lot of these, and it's a very exciting time now because many people are addressing this issue and some consortia have been set up in both Europe and North America to study this question. So I'll end there and thank you for your attention. Take any questions.